I think a lot of you know that Christy and I have in our household a junior in high school. Our daughter Megan is at that stage where she is looking to see what's going to come after high school and looking at different colleges and opportunities and options that are there. So taking the SAT and going to different schools and getting on countless mailing lists. Oh my goodness, is my mailbox full every single day? There is something from some other college or some email trying to invite her to check things out because our school is the best. Some of these are well known, but I didn't realize how many obscure, tiny little colleges there are out there. She's getting invitations. Some of them she wants. Some of them she doesn't. Some of them try really hard, too. It's funny. Sometimes they, I guess with computers these days, they can personalize things, or at least try to. So she gets these invitations to Meg. Just to, so you know, nobody calls my daughter Megan Meg, but me. Well, and Christy. So she reads that and goes, what is this? Truth is, we're all getting invitations all the time, don't we? We get invitations to come to this place, to attend this event. We get invited to give money to this cause, to buy this product, to try this service, to vote this way, to follow this path. Their invitations are everywhere. And in the midst of it all, we need to be able to hear the invitation that comes to you and to me from Jesus. Specifically this morning, I want us to look at three invitations that come out of this 14th chapter of the Gospel of Luke as we continue our survey of this incredibly rich text. So let me ask you to turn there, if you would, with me, Luke chapter 14, where we're going to look at three different sections. And the way we'll do this morning is I'll read a section, I'll make some comments on it, reflect upon that, and the invitation that's there, and then we'll read the next section and kind of work our way through this text this morning. But again, it'll be important for you to have the text in front of you, so either pull that up on a phone or device that you're using, pull a Pew Bible out from the rack in front of you, or open up in the Bible you brought with you to Luke chapter 14. I'll invite you to follow along as I'll read this first section for us. Luke says that one Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee, he was being carefully watched. There in front of him was a man suffering from abnormal swelling of his body. And Jesus asked the Pharisees and experts in the law, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" But they remained silent. So taking hold of the man, he healed him and sent him on his way. Then he asked them, "If one of you has a child or an ox that falls into a well on the Sabbath day, will you not immediately pull it out?" And they had nothing to say. And when he noticed how the guests picked the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited both of you will come and say to you, "Give this person your seat." Then, humiliated, you'll have to take the least important place. But when you are invited, take the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he will say to you, "Friend, move up to a better place." Then you will be honored in the presence of all the other guests. For all of those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. We'll pause there. So once again, we see that Luke ushers us as his readers into a scene where Jesus is sitting down to a meal with people. Luke's gospel, in fact, actually seems to have more mealtime scenes than any of the other gospels. Luke just likes to show us a Jesus who enjoys feasting and friendships around the table. And in fact, Jesus' stories often center around banquets and parties and weddings. And here, what we're finding is basically Jesus goes out to lunch after church, kind of like many of us might like to do. After the synagogue Sabbath worship, he has been invited over to a Pharisee's house, the home of one of the top leaders of this Pharisee group. And once again, the issue of healing on the Sabbath has been raised. Now Luke, who recall is also a physician as well as the gospel writer, says that a man was there who had dropsy, or an abnormal swelling in his body. Now, why is he there? We don't know. It could be that this man has come of his own initiative, his own volition, to seek healing from Jesus. It could be that he's there as a stooge. He's basically a plant by the Pharisees to see if Jesus will again heal on the Sabbath. So while we don't know that, we do know that in another miracle that is unique to Luke's gospel, Jesus reaches out and he touches and he heals. As is so often the case, people like the Pharisees in this scene lack the emotional health and the spiritual maturity to confront issues head on. They prefer to murmur, to gossip, to talk amongst themselves about things, to complain to each other. But not Jesus. So he brings the question right out into the open, and he asks, is it permitted to heal on the Sabbath, yes or no? Well, if they say yes, they give an unwanted endorsement to Jesus. But if they say no, they reveal their hearts, that they are more concerned with proving they are right than with proving their love. They're more interested in making a point than in making a difference. So Jesus calls out the hypocrisy of the Pharisees, and he silences his critics, pointing out that they themselves would come to the rescue of their child or even an animal that fell into a well on the Sabbath. They would do the necessary work to rescue. So how much more? Why shouldn't Jesus rescue this man from his bondage to the physical condition that has enslaved him? Jesus then tells a short parable or a story sermon about guests at a wedding feast. But please note that Jesus is doing more here than just giving some practical advice on navigating social situations. He isn't just kind of saying, so here's what you do. If you want to have the best seats, take the low one because then they'll move you up. He's not just kind of doing some social advice column here. He's driving at a deeper meaning. He's addressing the attitude of the heart before God as well as other people. When these guests at the Pharisees' dinner party that Jesus is sitting there at come to the table, he sees they're elbowing each other. They're jostling for position. One guy gets up and goes to the restroom, and another guy comes in and takes his seat. They're trying to make themselves one up on everyone else. Now, in Jesus' day, it was all too easy for these well-off, well-educated Pharisees to imagine that they are somehow superior to those who are poorer, to those who had less, to those who couldn't measure up to their really high standards. But the truth is, we can fall very easily into that same pit, that same one-up trap, if we're not careful, because we can begin to see ourselves, our spirituality, even our standing before God, as somehow automatically being greater than somebody who is different from us from any reason. I mean, be honest, when you think about yourself and the state of your soul and your life and your spiritual condition, and you compare yourself to, say, the homeless man living down in Seattle under a bridge, or the gay couple in Richmond Beach raising a child, or somebody who was in Cambodia on those slides that Judy just showed. For many of us, whether near or far, when we think about somebody who is significantly different in some way, shape, or form, it's easy to begin to think a little one-up, that we're in a superior place. And spiritual arrogance of that sort, as subtle as it is, can be very destructive. And so Jesus confronts it in love when he says, for all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves, verse 11, will be exalted. There's a story about a young man named David who received a parrot for his birthday. Now, the parrot that he got was fully grown, was very talkative, and actually was very proud of being a parrot. Unfortunately, this bird with a bad attitude had an even worse vocabulary. Every other word was some sort of expletive, and those that weren't were, needless to say, they were rude. This bird, every time it opened its mouth, just kind of squawked out arrogant boasts and crude put-downs. Well, David tired of it all, and he tried to change the bird's attitude. He was constantly trying to influence it by example, saying polite things. He tried playing soft music to kind of ease the bird's mood. He tried anything he possibly could, and nothing worked with this arrogant parrot. He finally yelled at the proud bird, told it to just be quiet, but the bird got worse. He shook the bird, and the bird got madder and ruder. Finally, in a moment of desperation, David put that parrot in the freezer, and he slammed the door shut. And for a few moments, he heard the bird squawking and kicking and screaming, and then all went quiet. Well, David was a bit frightened that he might have actually hurt the bird, so he quickly opened the freezer door, and the parrot was there, calmly stepped out onto David's extended arm. And the parrot said, and I quote, "I'm sorry that I might have offended you with my language and actions and wholeheartedly ask for your forgiveness. I will endeavor to correct my behavior." Well, David was astounded at the bird's change in attitude and was about to ask what had changed him when the parrot continued, "And sir, may I ask, what did the chicken do?" Jesus says, all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. And it really isn't a laughing matter. William Temple has been quoted as saying, "Humility does not mean thinking less of yourself than of other people, nor does it mean having a low opinion of your own gifts. It means freedom from thinking about yourself one way or the other at all." But then he continues with this phrase that's important for many of us who claim the name of Christian. "The humility which consists in being a great deal occupied about yourself and saying you are of little worth is not Christian humility. It is one form of self-occupation and a very poor and futile one at that." To use the common paraphrase, true humility is not thinking less of yourself. It is thinking of yourself less. And that's the invitation Jesus gives to this humility that will in turn actually completely reorient us. And he gives it to us not just as individuals, but I believe he gives it to us together as a church, this invitation to a reorienting humility. In fact, a good litmus test of any church community is to see how many activities it engages in that are outwardly directed as opposed to being inwardly focused and self-serving. Exalting ourselves, putting ourselves first and foremost in all things, can be a subtle form of arrogance even for churches. Which is why I'm just so pleased that over the last years at Calvin, we have continued to try to be working at examining the programs of our church and the funds in our budget and asking tough questions about how things are used for our own interest versus being put to use in a way that represents giving to our community and our world and what God is doing outside of our own walls. It's trying to reorient ourselves into a more humble posture. It's responding to this very invitation of Jesus. But there's more. Let's continue. Verse 12. Luke continues to write, saying, "Then Jesus said to his host, 'When you give a luncheon or dinner, do not invite your friends, your brothers or sisters, your relatives, or your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you will be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous.'" And Luke continues, "When one of those at the table with him heard this, he said to Jesus, 'Blessed are those who will eat at the feast of the kingdom of God.' Jesus replied, 'A certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. At the time of the banquet, he sent his servant to tell those who had been invited, "Come, for everything is now ready." But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said, 'I have just bought a field and I must go and see it. Please excuse me.' Another said, 'I have just bought 5 yoke of oxen and I'm on my way to try them out. Please excuse me.' Still another said, 'I just got married, so I can't come.' The servant came back and reported this to his master. Then the owner of the house became angry, and he ordered his servant, 'Go out quickly into the streets and the alleys of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind.' 'Sir,' the servant said, 'what you ordered has been done, but there is still room.' Then the master told his servant, 'Go out onto the roads and the country lanes and compel them to come in so that my house will be full.' And Jesus adds, 'I tell you, not one of those who are invited will get a taste of my banquet.'" While the earlier words from Jesus about seating at the dinner table had a deeper meaning than social advice, Jesus here seems intent on giving some real instructions. Invite the poor and the needy to dinner. While guests ought not presume upon their importance in the eyes of their hosts, hosts should not be exclusive about whom they invite. Jesus explains that they shouldn't invite only people who can pay them back. Don't just give for what you might get in return. So perhaps here is the point where I ought to ask, what are you doing for Easter? What are you doing for an Easter meal? Are you inviting anyone over? And who might that be? You know, we have talked a lot as a church together about hospitality over the last months and even year or so. We talked about how we're going to live that out. How are we going to live that out even this next week? Verse 15, Luke tells us that when one of those at the table heard this, he said to Jesus, "Blessed are those who will eat at the feast in the kingdom of God." A very insightful New Testament scholar named Kenneth Bailey comments on this, helps kind of unpack that. He writes, "The person's outburst is actually a challenge for Jesus to express his views on that topic. Those around the table would expect Jesus to say something such as, 'Oh, that we might keep the law in precise fashion so that when that great day comes, we will be counted worthy to sit with the Messiah and all true believers at his banquet.'" Bailey adds that the reclining guests would then have nodded approvingly and thought to themselves, "Ah, fine, he passed that exam. Now let's move on to the next topic." But Jesus responds with a very different view of the messianic banquet of the end times from the current views of the community. Because see, Jesus understands that that messianic banquet is his banquet. So he tells what's often called the parable of the great banquet. And he switches the emphasis from who we should invite to how we should respond to God's invitation. Let's look at a little bit closer. Verse 16, Jesus replied, "A certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. At that time of the banquet, he sent his servant to tell those who had been invited, 'Come, for everything is now ready.'" Again, let me just try to translate the cultural distance here. It makes sense. He sends out the invitations to all sorts of people that he wants to invite into his home to have this celebration, this banquet. All of them come back with a big yes, an affirmative, "We will be there." But again, first century culture, he can't just set a time. People don't just have the watches. They don't have their phones. He can't just send out an email burst that says, you know, the time is here to come. And so he has to make his plans based on the number of RSVPs that he has received. He plans what meat, what fowl he's going to butcher. He spends the day preparing that. He gets the feast ready. And then there has to be the second invitation that says, with the standard classical phrase, "Please come, everything is now ready." But verse 18, after all of those preparations, they all alike begin to make excuses. The first says, "I've just bought a field and I must go and see it. Please excuse me." That's a lame excuse. Because nobody goes out and just buys a field unseen. You've got to check to see if it's going to be able to support your crops. You have to check to see if it has been polluted in any way. Does it actually measure up to the measurements that are there? Buying a field in that first century culture was a very long, drawn-out process. This doesn't happen. It is an inexcusable excuse. Another said, "I've just bought 5 yoke of oxen. I'm on my way to try them out. Please excuse me." Again, oxen are not purchased without taking them for a test drive. You don't buy these pairs sight unseen because you have to figure out, will they pull together? Will they be unequally yoked? Will one begin to pull stronger than the other and cause them to turn? Or will they go in a straight line? It's a lame excuse. And then the third one, still another said, "I just got married, so I can't come." Yeah, like you didn't see that coming. You didn't know you were about to get married? Why did you say yes in the first place? That somehow from the first invitation to now, this just snuck up on you? Imagine you're giving a dinner party. You've extended the first invitation, and your guests have arrived. You've opened, imagine, I mean, we clean our houses, we get things ready, the people come, we seat them in the living room, we serve them some hors d'oeuvres while we get the final preparations made back in the kitchen. And then the time comes, the food is ready, it gets all placed out on the table, things are piping hot, you're ready to go, you invite the group from your dining room, say, "Please, come in out of the living room, come to the dining room, come and join me." And they all get up, and they start to head for the door instead of the dining room. And they start saying things like, "I just remembered, I've got to go feed my cat." Which is a lame excuse, even for a cat lover, Linda. Verse 21, the servant came back and reported this to his master. Then the owner of the house became angry. He is insulted, he is incensed, He is understandably irate at the injustice that's been done. But he orders his servant, go out quickly into the streets and alleys of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, the lame. Do you notice that phrase again? It's the same group that Jesus said we should be inviting to dinner. This master does. But don't miss in that a remarkable turn of redemption. The banquet host's anger has been reprocessed into grace. Rather than choosing the supposed response that everybody would anticipate that he would do of going and seeking justice, of seeking revenge, he has chosen an unprecedented option. He chooses to reprocess his anger into grace and extends the invitation more broadly than ever before. The folks are now welcomed into his banquet who are not even worthy to be seated with such a noble host and who have no possibility of repaying the master. And beyond that, he then sends the servant out yet again to places where people do not even know the master by name. They've never heard of him, so the servant has to compel these people to come in, telling them of the master's goodness. Do you see the parallel? Jesus concludes with a sharp comment directed back to his listeners. Verse 24, I tell you, not one of those who are invited will get a taste of my banquet. Now, it's easy to miss in a shift here, so let me unpack this for us. Throughout the parable, it is the master speaking in the singular to the servant. But here the phrase, I tell you, is plural. The speaker of that phrase is no longer the master in the parable, but it is Jesus addressing the guests with whom he is eating at the Pharisee's house. Jesus says to those seated right in front of him, I am the Messiah, and the messianic banquet is mine, and you have shunned my invitation. Do we? There's an invitation extended to each one of us of a redemptive hospitality. But we too are now to return, like that servant in the parable, to invite others. And I am so excited about some of the conversations I've had. Even this last week, I talked to two different people who said, I have come to Calvin for the very first time, and I have never been to a church that is so friendly and welcoming. Hey, Calvin Church, good on you. Well done. That is what we want to be about on a Sunday morning, extending a welcome and saying hello and greeting those who come to join us for worship. But I also had another interesting conversation. Actually, it was an email exchange with somebody who's not been around for a while, who was newer to our congregation. And I just checked in and said, I haven't seen you. I hope you're doing well. And she shared with me that she, too, had received a wonderful welcome when she first began to attend. She tried to actually invite people from Calvin to come to her home for dinner and tried to get to know them, but was never invited back. She tried to get involved in small groups and in different studies, but couldn't seem to break in. So I want to say we are doing well in so many areas at extending a redemptive hospitality. We have room that we need to continue to grow to not just welcome people into our building and into our worship, but folks, let's continue to find ways to welcome people into our lives. And Luke has one last thing for us as we turn towards home here. Verse 25. He writes, large crowds were traveling with Jesus, and turning to them, he said, if anyone comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even life itself, such a person cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not carry their cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Verse 28, suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Won't you first sit down and estimate the cost to see if you have enough money to complete it? For if you lay the foundation and are not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule you, saying, this person began to build and wasn't able to finish. Or suppose a king is about to go to war against another king. Won't he first sit down and consider whether he is able, with 10,000 men, to oppose the one coming against him with 20,000? If he is not able, he will send a delegation while the other is still a long way off and will ask for terms of peace. In the same way, those of you who cannot give up everything you have cannot be my disciples. Salt is good, but if it loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is fit neither for the soil nor for the manure pile. It is thrown out. Whoever has ears to hear, let them hear. I shared a week or two ago that Christy and I are in that place with one of our cars that It requires some repair work that actually will cost more than the car is worth itself. So we're trying to figure out whether to do that or to buy a new car. And so actually Friday we were out doing a little shopping to see what kind of options are available if we were to buy a new car, and went to one particular dealer and did the test drive. And we're very clear that we weren't buying that day, but we needed to walk out with some numbers to make a decision. We needed to know what the cost of the car was going to be. And, you know, nobody wants to tell you that. In fact, there seem to be all sorts of, have you noticed? I mean, there's like the MSRP, the suggested retail price, then there's the invoice price, but then there's all these other fees, the tax, license, registration, the dock fee, whatever that is. And this guy went into the back room to go talk to his finance people to find out the out-the-door price of the car. And we sat there for almost a half an hour. And we left because we couldn't find out the cost. I'm not going to tell you where. Jesus has no desire to do a bait and switch. Jesus doesn't want there to be hidden costs. Jesus wants to practice for disciples what we might call that upfront pricing. He wants us to know what it means to follow him. So again, verse 25, when those crowds are following Jesus, turning to them, he said, "If any comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even life itself, such a person can't be my disciple." Jesus is not denying the importance of family or of caring for yourself appropriately. What he's doing here is using that word hate in a comparative sense. It's actually a figure of speech. It's a Semitic hyperbole. It's an obvious exaggeration to make a sharp point. And the point is, Jesus is to be loved above all else. Jesus is to be followed before all others. If we are ever forced to choose, the winner must be Jesus. In the time when when Luke writes this gospel, no one embraced Jesus casually. To follow Jesus generally meant facing rejection and ridicule and potential harm. And so in verse 27, he says, "Whoever does not carry their cross and follow me, again, cannot be my disciple." Jesus' audience knows what it looks like to carry a cross. They have seen it. And Jesus is about to take the symbol of the cross and transform it. Again, today is Passion Sunday, or Palm Sunday. It's a day that we remember Jesus' entry into Jerusalem, and we remember that those crowds who that day shouted, "Hosanna," will soon be shouting, "Crucify him." Jesus says these words here, knowing that he is about to carry his own cross. And while it would bring immediate death, it would also bring eternal life. Jesus is leading us only where he has gone and is going. Jesus does not ask of us anything he has not already done for us. He has paid that ultimate cost. You know, in the church, we sometimes use the language in talking about our faith. We talk about inviting Jesus into your life. And while there are a couple verses that kind of allude to that in the Gospels, really in the larger message of the Gospel that Jesus lives and proclaims, we will find that it is Jesus inviting us into his life. "Follow me," he says. And after giving two illustrations of the importance of counting the cost before a grand endeavor, Jesus adds this, verse 33, "In the same way, those of you who do not give up everything you have cannot be my disciples." We have got to hear this. But we need to hear it well. And in this, I find Dallas Willard, writing this book, Renovation of the Heart, really helpful. This is what Willard says. He says, "The impression gained by most who hear about counting the cost of following Jesus is one of how terrible and painful that cost is. But to count the cost is to take into consideration both the losses and the gains of all possible courses of action to see which is most beneficial. This done, Jesus knew, the trials of apprenticeship or discipleship would appear to be the only reasonable path. As has been said, he is not a fool who gives up what he cannot keep for the sake of what he can never lose. The cost of non-discipleship would then be seen for what it is, unbearable. That is why one would become able to sustain cheerfully the much smaller cost of discipleship to him." Folks, hopefully you are hearing some phrases over and over again that we're beginning to use more and more around this congregation. We talk about wanting to be reforming our world because we want to respond to that invitation we hear in this text to reorient ourselves with a humility that doesn't exalt ourselves but puts others first and be involved in what God is doing of sending us into our community and our world. You're going to keep hearing the phrase about forming community because we want to live into that second invitation of redemptive hospitality, that we receive it from Christ and we share it with all of one another and all those we encounter. But also we're about this last piece too of transforming lives. There is an invitation given to costly discipleship that will change you and change me from the inside out. Those in the crowd that day, and perhaps some of us this morning, need to hear it is time to count the cost, and it is time to commit. Discipleship to Jesus is not an add-on to your life, but the center and organizing principle of your life. Being a disciple to Jesus is not something you do as part of your life, but someone you are as you live out your life. It doesn't discount the room for growth. We all continue to discover areas of needed transformation. We never arrive, but there is a point where we need to commit. Will today be that day for you? Do you hear the invitation? Will you say yes to Jesus this morning? I pray that you will. In fact, let me pray for all of us right now.